By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
I'm Danielle Reed, and this is Moody's Talks, focused on finance. In today's episode, my co-host Carolyn Henson will talk to analysts Melina Scorridou, Stephen Tu, and Farouk Khan about forces changing the face of banking and finance as we know it, and what that will mean for traditional banks. Hi, Carolyn. Great to have you back.
Thanks, Danielle. It's good to be here.
So I think given the constant stream of news about the crypto space, from El Salvador making Bitcoin an official digital currency to big tech firms advancing further into activities that once belonged solely to banks, I think most people are aware that banking and finance as we know it are undergoing a transformation. So what do Melina, Stephen, and Farouk have to say about all this?
Well, Danielle, it certainly is a rapidly changing scene. We'll be talking about four broad forces that are reshaping the financial landscape and that are threatening to dislodge banks from their traditional role as middlemen in finance. So these forces are first big tech firms like Google and Facebook, then smaller pure play fintechs like Square or PayPal. Third, there's stateless finance, such as stablecoins. And then lastly, more state-developed digital money, namely central bank digital currencies.
That is going to be a really interesting conversation. But first, we have Fast Finance, where Moody's analysts give their views on the credit implications of current events. Joining me now from Singapore is Alka Anbarasu. Alka, thanks for joining.
Thanks, Daniel. Glad to be here.
So, Alka, about your recent report on Indian banks and the second wave of COVID-19 in India. First, what industries in particular are going to see non-performing loans increase as a result of the second wave, which thankfully seems to have subsided now, but was really intense over the summer? And second, how much do you expect the non-performing loans to increase?
Okay, Daniel, let me first start with the good news. The economic impact of the second wave will create new NPLs for the Indian banks, but we don't expect their asset quality to severely deteriorate. And this is important because Indian banks have faced significant asset quality challenges in the past decade. Just to elaborate on what will be the impact of this time around, we expect the quality of loans to retail customers and small and medium enterprises will deteriorate. And this is because the lockdown measures and the healthcare cost have hurt the financial buffers of the Indian households. On the other hand, the quality of corporate loans will be broadly stable as legacy corporate loans have been largely resolved in the system. Just to put some numbers in context, we did some analysis on the rated state-owned banks and assumed that their new NPL formation will increase by 50% in this year compared to last year. Despite this assumption, we expect the overall NPL ratios of the banks will remain stable and moderately inch down over the next 12 to 18 months because of resolution of legacy loans as well as loan growth.
I see. But you also said in the report that the banks have enough capital to weather this surge in non-performing loans.
Yeah, that's another interesting point. So, till a few years ago, our key credit concern on the Indian banks was their weak solvency, a result of their weak asset quality, capital and profitability. So we talked about asset quality, which is a bit on the mend, and bank capitalization has materially strengthened over the past few years. So last year, the Indian banks raised over $8 billion in new equity capital. And in the past 4 years, the Indian government has infused over $38 billion as new equity capital into the state-owned banks. So all in, the banks are well capitalized now. For reference, the state-owned banks' Common Equity Tier 1 ratio or CET1 ratio is now over 10%, and that for the private sector banks is now over 13%.
Alka, thank you. And now for our second Fast Finance topic, an update on hurricane-related insured losses in the U.S., we have Jasper Cooper from the PNC Insurance team. Jasper, welcome.
Hi, Danielle. Great to be here.
So Jasper, Hurricane Ida caused tragic loss of life and significant property damage in the Southeast U.S. and all the way up through the Mid-Atlantic. You've started to get some loss estimates in from firms that model those losses. What are they saying?
Thanks, Danielle. What makes Hurricane Ida interesting is that it hit several regions. First, it hit the Gulf states when it made landfall in Louisiana as a Category 4 hurricane on August 29th. Then it went through the Ohio Valley, Mid-Atlantic, and then hitting the Northeast, including New York and New Jersey, as a tropical depression a few days later. The major CAT modeling firms have given various estimates, some of which include Northeast losses and some don't. Some include flooding losses, some don't. And some include other lines like offshore drilling facilities and some don't. So these aren't apples to apples comparisons, but having made that disclaimer, there are at least four lost estimates out there from the major CAT modeling firms. RMS's estimate is 25 to 35 billion just for the Gulf states, including the federal flood insurance program losses. Obviously that estimate would be higher if you included the Northeast. Air Worldwide's estimate includes losses from winds and storm surge, and that's 17 to 25 billion. That includes the Gulf and Northeast, but it excludes losses from rain-induced floods. The CoreLogic estimate is 27 to 40 billion, but that includes both insured and uninsured losses. And then there's Karen Clark and Company's estimate of almost 18 billion, but that doesn't include the Northeast. So if you listen to the major catastrophe modeling firms, losses could be anywhere between $17 billion and $40 billion.
I see. So that's a pretty wide range, but in any case, certainly a major event.
So if Ida is at the top end of the range, the $40 billion, it could be the second largest hurricane in U.S. history in terms of insured losses, just after Katrina. So far this year, in addition to Ida, there's been hurricanes Henri and Nicholas. From what we're hearing, losses from Henri are limited. It's too early to know for sure about Nicholas, but I'm getting the sense they probably won't be too high from that either. But we still have a month and a half left of hurricane season, so unfortunately, there could still be some more storms.
Jasper, thank you for that update. And now I'm handing the mic over to my co-host, Carolyn Henson, who will be talking to Melina Scorridou, Farouk Khan, and Stephen Tu about the reshaping of finance and what it means for traditional banks.
Thanks, Danielle, and welcome, Melina, Steve, and Farouk. Steve, let's start with your take on some of the major forces that are transforming finance today. You've just published a report that talks about this. Can you take us through what's happening? What are the forces and how are they driving change?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Carolyn. So when we look at the landscape of what's going on in the world migrating to digital, we see, you know, four clear areas where you could have a lot of change coming, and those are, you know, from the big techs, as we've written about in the past, and then the pure play fintechs, which seem to be evolving and broadening their product lines. And also some of them are very interesting. They're new business models that kind of get to the core of financial services, which is assessing risk and making financial judgments. And then there's another important half, which, you know, Farouk and Melina will talk more about, which is digital currencies. And there you have the stateless side with things like DeFi and stablecoins that are pushing these central banks to modernize and launch central bank digital currencies. And so, you know, each of these forces, we think, could have very profound impacts to the financial landscape. And also you can imagine where they can kind of combine as well. So, for example, big techs, we wrote, you know, several years ago, they would be very influential because, you know, they need to just incorporate financial activity within their ecosystems, but they've been reluctant to because they don't want to take on that extra regulation of banking if they want to hold deposits and things like that. And with CBDCs, you know, if you can kind of combine the two, you can actually overcome that. And you have some interesting mixes where, you know, you can have like a PayPal or a Facebook wallet or a Googleplex wallet on top of a CBDC.
Interesting. Thanks. What's the latest status of big tech expansion into financial services?
Well, they continue to, you know, expand. So in the U.S., we've seen a lot of the big techs continue to add additional services, whether it's, you know, more payment related or a little bit of credit provision, BNPL, small business lending. And probably one of the most important developments over the past few years is the DM project, formerly known as Libra. And, you know, Facebook's Novi unit has been one of the, you know, key participants. And there you have the potential for a global stablecoin to be used within a very, very large technology ecosystem. And that's been one of the main catalysts for central banks to step up their efforts in providing a modern digital currency.
So what's the risk for traditional banks, especially if tech firms are looking to partner with them in many of these ventures?
Yeah, so partnerships is often mentioned, but again, with the advent of CBDCs, that could be less important, and you can kind of see an unbundling of a lot of the traditional banking services. And also with partnerships, there's only going to be a few a limited number of financial institutions that can partner with a tech app or an aggregator. So really, the key is that as we migrate to digital and as our lives become more digital, the interactions that we all have are more and more with these tech companies. And if they integrate financial services into their businesses, into their ecosystems, the customer relationship between the traditional consumer and the traditional bank just gets more and more distanced.
Right, thanks. And then you also talk about the nature of money itself and how it's updating for the digital age. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, so, I think one interesting thing to think about is, we're living in the 21st century and we can, I can send a package to you in London quicker than I can probably send a string of digits for transferring money and getting all that approved. And so why does money not move as fast as an email or text message? And it's because, the money that we use today that's electronic, it's really not what we probably associate with traditional money, like cash, which is the direct liability of the central bank. It's really a product of commercial banks. And when it moves, there's associated costs. It travels on different networks. It kind of navigates through different intermediaries and parties. And so it's a little bit slower. It's a little bit less. It's more expensive than just moving cash. A lot of our transactions in the past, I would go to a retailer, I would buy something, hand the person a dollar bill, and it settles instantaneously, and it's totally free. And we don't have a digital equivalent of that as more and more of our lives migrate to digital. So the private sector has realized that, and hence the whole development of stablecoins, DeFi. And then even, with the Diem coin. And in response, central banks have kind of realized that they need to modernize modern money to make it faster, cheaper, more inclusive. And, there you could see a potential leveling of the playing field where in the past, electronic money was really controlled by private commercial banks and other parties. And now you can see with the advent of CBDCs, which we're following this quite closely because it could have very profound implications on the financial landscape, that could really level the playing field for money, open it up to a range of players, including the incumbent banks and tech companies, big techs, fintechs, small techs, startups.
Thanks, Steve. And as you've mentioned, another risk for banks is coming from these central bank digital currencies. And Malin and Farouk have been doing some extensive research into that. So let's start from the beginning, if we could, Melina. Why are central banks all working to develop their own digital currencies?
Well, thank you, Caroline. It seems things are advancing at quite a fast pace. In terms of motives to introduce these central bank digital currencies, they vary across different countries. So worldwide, central banks are considering the evolution of payments and money, the switch to digital and the reduced use of cash. Some central banks see CBDCs as a way to diversify payments methods and reduce the concentration risk in the current payments infrastructure. While others think it will help increase financial inclusion. But I think the most important factor is that all central bankers are concerned about losing monetary control owing to the threat posed mainly by stablecoins that Steve was also mentioned before.
I see. And Farouk, to bring you in here, what's the threat to banks from CBDCs?
Well, CBDCs in and of themselves are disruptive. They provide a risk-free alternative to deposits that are the predominant funding source of banks. And we would likely see a shift into CBDCs from deposits, raising competition for bank deposits and a rise in bank funding costs. Now, central banks are aware of that. And all the pilots and proposals that we've looked at are based on something called the two-tier model. And that means that central banks see normal banks as part of future CBDC systems in terms of dissemination, client onboarding, and things like this. Now, the two-tier model is the one that we expect to be implemented broadly, but that doesn't mean that they don't still have an effect on banks. And the disruption that a CBDC can have on a bank really depends on the detail. And by the detail, I mean design choices. And these key features are the ones that will really determine the relative attractiveness and the ranking of a CBDC against other alternatives available as stores of value and as mediums of exchange. There are several design features to consider, but the two main ones that really pertain to banks are going to be holding limits. And by that, I mean the amount that an individual is allowed to hold of CBDC, and whether CBDCs are interest-bearing. Now, if holding limits are too high, then deposit shifts can be more pronounced. Now, if they're too low, then convenience of use would suffer. In terms of whether CBDCs bear interest or not, in countries where rates are negative, even a zero interest-bearing CBDC can lead to a rise in bank funding costs. And in countries with positive rates, if a CBDC is non-interest-bearing, then the flows into it from deposits would really be determined by its risk-free nature and its convenience of use. And central banks just have to balance what they create, given all the private sector alternatives that exist at the moment.
Great. But undoubtedly, isn't privacy a big issue as well with these new digital currencies?
Well, the importance of privacy in CBDC's use varies depending on the jurisdiction, but it's definitely a big one in the more advanced economies. I mean, in Europe, for example, Europeans ranked an assurance of privacy as the most important feature of a digital euro. That was done in a recent ECB public consultation. And the head of the European Data Protection Board reiterated this point and said certain suggestions and requirements that the digital euro should satisfy from a data safety perspective. However, it seems that a fully anonymous CBDC doesn't appear to be an option, as it would lead to breaches of existing anti-money laundering rules.
So ultimately, the risk is that banks face the risk of being displaced and could lose some fee revenue. Is that a fair assessment, Farouk?
Yes, I'll definitely say so. CBDCs, as Melina mentioned, would enable broad use of instant payments run centrally through systemically stable and likely cheaper central bank infrastructure. That's going to be to the detriment of banks and other payment system providers. And, you know, banks make a lot of money from fees, from payment activities. We estimate from 2016 to 2020, the median amount of revenues made from fees and commissions were around 24%.
Yeah, we came across other data that had the estimated payments-related profits coming to about 2.3% of U.S. GDP and 2.6% of global GDP. And so that's a huge amount of friction that could be alleviated.
No, definitely. That's a big number. And how much fee revenue the banks will really use will really depend on how much CBDCs are used and their cost advantage versus existing payment systems. And also, it's important to remember that banks make money through cross-border payments as well. And that could take a hit if there's an international interconnected CBDC paradigm in the near future.
So it's probably a little early to tell what the real impact is going to be from some of these changes, especially CBDCs, although we're getting close there. In fact, there are some currencies that have already launched, I think, and are past the pilot phase. Farouk, what do we know about those?
Well, we've had the sand dollar launch in the Bahamas, and that's been in operation for a while. And we have various countries in pilot phase, most notably China. An exciting recent development is Project Dumbo, which is seeing the central banks of Singapore, Australia, Malaysia, and South Africa testing CBDCs for cross-border settlements. They're going to present the technical prototypes in November at the Singapore FinTech Fair. So it really does seem that CBDCs could well be coming sooner than thought to a wallet near you.
Well, it's definitely going to be interesting to see how it all unfolds. Farouk, Melina, Steve, Carolyn, Jasper, and Alka, thank you all very much for your insights. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. To read any of the reports referenced in this podcast, you can click on the link for this episode at about.moodys.io/podcasts. And please tune in again on Wednesday, October 6th for the next episode of Focus on Finance.